today's Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. My name is John Scandura, and I'm vice chairman of this board, and we are coming to you today from the Orange County Sanitation District's facilities here in Fountain Valley. I want to thank the Orange County the San Districts for hosting us here at this beautiful facility, and I think this is the first time we've been here. So we are meeting in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcasted and recorded. For those who have completed a virtual speaker card for this Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera will be turned off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting. For the people who want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is also available. So we have here at the facility four board members, and then we have two of our board members who are actually coming to us remotely. I would first of all like to ask the board members who are here to introduce themselves, beginning with board member Al Lopez.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Al Lopez, former mayor and councilman, City of Corona, and also a longtime board member of Western Municipal Water District in Riverside County.
Good morning, everyone. Gloria Alvarado, resident of the City of Santa Ana, neighboring city. And I would just like to thank everyone for being here today.
Good morning, everyone. Board Member Letitia Clark. I live in the city of Tustin, and it's an honor to be with you this morning. Thank you.
Hey, and Board Member Rue.
Yes, good morning. I am Bill Rue, council member from the city of Montclair, California, and I wish everybody a wonderful morning. Unfortunately, I can't be there in person due to a very heavy-duty workload this week, so through the virtue and the miracles of Zoom, I can still attend. Thank you.
And Chair Chris Murray.
Good morning, colleagues and staff and everyone who's participating in our program or meeting today. Pleasure to join you. Sorry I can't be there in person, but I'm there with you in spirit and via Zoom, and look forward to our meeting today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, today.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Murray. And then finally, I'm John Scandura. I'm vice chair of this board. I live in Huntington Beach, just a few exits down from the freeway. I've been there for 31 years, but this afternoon I'm happy to say that I'm going to be going back to my hometown in the Inland Empire for my high school reunion. So I graduated from Chaffee High School in Ontario. I'm not going to tell you when I graduated. 11. So we do have a quorum. A majority of the board is here with us in person, and Chair Murray and Board Member Rue participating remotely. The Open Meeting Act requires board members who are participating remotely to disclose whether there are any individuals 18 years or older in the same room, and if so, state the general nature of their relationship with those individuals.
No, I have no one here in the room. I'm by myself.
And Chair Murray.
Likewise, I'm alone. Thank you so much.
Great. And the Open Meeting Act also requires remote board members must remain on camera for the entire open portion of this meeting that is publicly accessible via the internet. If a board member needs to turn off their camera during the open portion of the meeting, they must announce their reason for doing so the council can advise whether an exception to the on-camera rule applies. So with that, we now have our public forum. Any person may address the Santa Ana Water Board at any matter within the board's jurisdiction, provided the matter does not appear elsewhere on the agenda and has not been scheduled to appear on a future agenda and is not otherwise pending before the board. So we welcome the hearing. Already said that. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards for the public forum?
No, we do not.
Okay. With that, we move on to item number 3, and I would like to, it's my pleasure to introduce to you the State Water Resource Control Board Vice Chair, Doreen DiAdamo, who will provide an update from the State Water Resources Control Board. And Doreen, are you ready? Okay, she does.
Hey, Doreen, you have to.
There we go. Okay, sorry about that. I'm on travel and experiencing some technical difficulties. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yes, okay. We can.
All right. The first item that I wanted to update you on is the Bay Delta plan. On July 24th, our staff released a revised draft of the water quality control plan. That has been a project that we've been working on for many years, and I know I've updated you on this before. We do have hearings scheduled for later this month, but stay tuned for some updated announcements that will be coming out today or Monday regarding process for review for the updated Bay Delta plan. I can't say more than that. There's just been a lot of activity going on, and so working on an announcement soon. Next week at our board meeting on September 17th, we will be holding a public hearing to consider a designation of the Kern County sub-basin as a probationary basin. And I'm really pleased to report that the recommendation that we now have from staff is not to put the basin on probation, but to actually return the basin to the Department of Water Resources. The basin's been busy the last several months updating their plans, providing very specific and clear information about mitigation of impacts to drinking water wells, groundwater levels, subsidence. And so we're just really pleased that the basin has made such progress and turning them back to oversight at the Department of Water Resources. It doesn't mean that we won't ever be involved in the basin, but for the next round of reviews, their five-year review will be at the Department of Water Resources. And if a determination is made that there's insufficient progress towards sustainability, then it is possible that the basin could come back to us for consideration for probation. Next week on September 18th, the Safer Advisory Group will hold a meeting. The meeting is virtual, but there will also be physical and remote meeting locations for the public to participate in that meeting. And then update on the Delta Conveyance and Sites project. Two petitions that are before are the Administrative Hearings Office. On September 4th, the Administrative Hearings Office held a status conference on the pending petition for the Sites Project Authority. And on June 20th, the Administrative Hearings Office released a sixth amended hearing notice for the Delta Conveyance Project. And that hearing did resume on September 2nd. And we'll be continuing through September and into October via Zoom. Next week, we will be reviewing staff's recommendation on the annual fees. Staff did hold the final fee stakeholder meetings in August. This is for drinking water, environmental lab accreditation program, water rights, and water quality. And we will be taking those up next week on September 16th at our board meeting. And at the last board meeting that we had on September 3rd, we adopted a resolution to amend and actually provide for a full rewrite of the underground storage tank regulations that are in the California Code of Regulations. The rulemaking will be provided to the Office of Administrative Law for review and then become effective on January 1st. The purpose of the full rewrite is to make the regulations consistent with current technologies and to implement amendments to the Health and Safety Code, including the requirement to permanently close single-walled underground storage. And then lastly, I did have some questions at the last update on PFAS, and so wanted to provide some additional information for you all in follow-up. The PFAS testing is required at all water system sources under the federal maximum contaminated level currently that's in place all water system sources will need either a test from every quarter of the year for larger systems or twice a year for small systems by the year 2027. U.S. EPA has indicated its intent to take a formal regulatory action to modify the MCL to extend the compliance period and modify the limits for several substances while retaining the limits for specifically for PFOA and PFOS. Our staff has begun its own MCL setting process for PFOA, PFOS, and PFHXS, which are the three PFOSs shown to have the most impact at health impacting levels in California. And this process will take place over the next several years. That's all I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, well, thank you, Vice Chair DeAdamo. And do our board members have any questions or comments? And I'll begin with our members here here in Fountain Valley.
No.
No? Board Member Rue, no. Chair Murray?
No.
Okay.
And thank you so much, though, for always a thorough report.
And thank you very much, Vice Chair DeAdamo, for participating in our meeting today. And good luck next week.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Our next item is the approval of the minutes for the July 25th, 2025 board meeting. Do we have a motion?
This is Bill Rue. I'll make a motion for the minutes as presented.
And second. Who second?
Second.
Okay. Motion by Board Member Rue, second by Board Member Lopez. And can we please take a vote?
Board Member Lopez?
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado?
Aye.
Board Member Clark?
Aye.
Board Member Rue?
Aye.
Chair Murray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandora?
Aye. Okay, well, thank you. So the next item is item five is consideration of our consent calendar that's listed as items 6 and 7 on the agenda. At this time, I would like to ask if there are any interested persons or board member requests to remove the consent items. So I have no requests. And then do we have any speaker cards?
No, we do not.
Okay. Any board member comments on those two items?
I would like to make a motion for the consent calendar as presented.
Okay. Yeah, second?
No, second.
Okay. So motion by Board Member Rue, second by Board Member Clark. And could we take a vote?
Board Member Lopez?
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado?
Aye.
Board Member Clark?
Aye.
Board Member Rue?
Aye.
And Chair Murray?
Aye.
And Vice Chair Scandora?
Aye. Okay, thank you. So our next item is on the confined animal facilities program and non-point source agricultural program updates here in the Santa Ana region. This is an information item. Brian Covoloni, a senior engineering geologist, will introduce staff who will give a presentation on confined animal facilities program and non-point source agriculture program updates. Brian?
Thank you, Vice Chair Scandora. This informational item will provide an update on two programs managed under the agricultural and cannabis section. We will pause in between the transition or during the transition and ask the board members whether they would like to ask questions at that point or save questions until the end of both presentations. With that, I would like to introduce Michael Kashak, who will give our first presentation.
Good morning, board members. As Brian mentioned, my name is Michael Kashak. I am an environmental scientist at the Water Board. Like you said, this will be a two-part presentation. We'll be pausing halfway through to take any questions, or we can wait till the end. Slide. So this is an outline of what we are covering today. I'm going to start with some background information about our current regional dairy permit. I'll define animal feeding operations, what our inspections entail, and types of enforcement. And then Regina, as mentioned, will present on the second portion covering the non-point source program. Slide. Okay, to start off, why do we regulate animal facilities? While some potential pollutants associated with these facilities include ammonia, nitrogen and phosphorus, organic matter, sediments, pathogens, hormones, and antibiotics. Discharges from these facilities can include manure, wastewater, and stormwater. For example, there may be potential for stormwater to flow through manured areas before discharging. Also, if on-site retention ponds are not properly maintained, there is potential for retained wastewater to overflow during heavy rains. So as I mentioned in the previous slide, if retention ponds are not properly maintained, wastewater might overflow. And this slide shows an example of a retention pond in our region. These ponds essentially receive wastewater and stormwater, and depth markers are required to indicate the minimum capacity necessary to contain wash water and rainfall during a 25-year, 24-hour storm event. And a 25-year, 24-hour storm event is one where 24 hours of rainfall is expected to occur once every 25 years. And in this slide, I'll define AFOs and CAFOs. It's a busy slide, but I'll summarize. In the first bullet, animal feeding operations, or AFOs, they are operations where animals are confined and fed for 45 or more days in a 12-month period. And in the second bullet, concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, are animal feeding operations that meet the regulatory definition of a large, medium, or small CAFO. And the word concentrated refers to a high density of animals in a relatively small space. And CAFOs are point sources and are regulated under the NPDES program. And I'll break down each CAFO designation, large, medium, and small, over the next few slides. So if you look at the table to the right, you'll see that the leftmost column lists different animal types. And the other three columns identify thresholds for the number of animals housed at large, medium, and small CAFOs. And we'll start by looking at the large CAFO designation, which is defined as a facility housing at least the number of animals circled in red. And this large designation is strictly a population designation. A medium concentrated animal feeding operation must house the number of animals circled in red and either has a man-made ditch or pipe that carries manure or wastewater to a water of the U.S. Or the animals come into contact with surface water that passes through areas where they are confined. And the last of the three CAFO types is the small designation. These CAFOs must house fewer than the number of animals circled in red and has been designated as a CAFO by us as a significant contributor of pollutants. This can be a little confusing, so maybe a simple way to think about the term animal feeding operations versus confined animal feeding operations is that AFOs are generally based on how long animals are housed at a facility versus CAFOs, which are generally classified by animal population. So now I've identified, now that I've identified animal feeding operations and confined animal feeding operations, I'll touch on our regional dairy permit. This permit was adopted in December of 2018 and became effective in March 2019. This permit regulates dairies and related facilities, such as heifer ranches and calf nurseries. It serves as an NPDES permit for point source discharges from CAFOs, and it also serves as a waste discharge requirement permit that covers discharges to the waters of the U.S., waters of the state. The regional board determined that all animal feeding operations with a herd size of more than 20 dry or milking cows or 50 heifers, calves, or cattle are a significant contributor of pollutants to waters of the U.S. and are therefore covered under this permit. And as a reminder, facilities with these herd sizes that have been, are, or will be stabled or confined and fed for a total of 45 or more days in any 12-month period are required to obtain permit coverage. So some regional considerations of the current permit includes salt and nutrient loading in the Chino and San Jacinto basins, and provisions include region-wide salt and nutrient management requirements, such as a nutrient management plan, the Middle Santa Ana River Bacteria TMDL, salt management for the Chino Basin through the Optimum Basin Management Program, and salt management for the San Jacinto Basin through the Lake Elsinore and Canyon Lake Nutrient TMDL. So here are the current average and maximum herd sizes in our region. Looking at the average row, we have mostly milking cows and calves at 1,000 heads each as a region-wide average. Some have more, some have less. The bottom row is the maximum number of animals at any one facility. You'll notice that currently, the facility with the most milking cows houses 4,200 heads, and the facility with the most calves houses 4,500 heads, both significantly higher than the other animal types. The far right column identifies feedlot populations, and these are non-dairy facilities, and they house primarily beef cattle for fattening and eventual slaughter. I do want to note that these herd sizes are reported by the permittee annually. Annual reports trickle in after the due date, and we are still processing some of those most recent reports. So these numbers might slightly change. And to give an idea of how many animals are in this region, our region alone, these are animal populations for all permitted facilities combined between calendar years 2022 and 2024. The numbers on this chart represent the average number of animals per year for all facilities combined, again, only for this region. For example, the blue represents the number of milking cows. The 42,484 number takes into account the number of milking cows at all dairies combined per year for the last 3 years. And going clockwise in orange, we had an annual average of 7,643 dry cows, in gray, 15,281 heifers, in brown, over 15,000 calves, and 1,204 other animal types. And the category other animal types would include horses, bulls, steers, sheep, goats, and non-dairy cattle. And again, we're still processing some of the annual reports, so these numbers could slightly change as it takes time to get all these reports in and accounted for. So we have all these animals in the region generating manure. And it's worth mentioning that these facilities produce between 300 tons and 25,000 tons of manure per year. And that manure is either stockpiled on site, spread on cropland at the facility, hauled to fertilizer companies, or hauled to farmers for ag applications or any combination of these. And manure manifests are submitted to us as part of the discharger's annual report. So dairy distribution. This map shows the distribution of dairies in the region. The majority of our dairies are in the Chino, Ontario, and San Jacinto areas. There are currently 44 dairies in the Chino and Ontario areas, and 26 in the San Jacinto area, with the exception of a few outliers. We also have an individual permit for the Los Alamitos Racecourse, which combines stormwater and confined animal program components. The facility is not shown on this map, but it's located in the city of Cypress. So enrolled facilities. Here are the total number of enrolled facilities over the last 5 years, fiscal years. Starting on the left in 2020, we had nearly 100 enrollees, and over the course of 5 years, we've seen an overall decline in the number of enrollees, currently putting us at 70. And I think it's worth mentioning that our dairy program has been around since the 1970s, and historically, our facilities were individually permitted, but we switched to a general permit in the 90s. And at that time, there were approximately 500 dairies in the region. In this slide, I'll touch on the enrollment and termination process. When a facility operator applies for permit coverage, they submit a notice of intent. If that notice of intent is approved, we send the permittee a letter confirming their enrollment. That letter is called a Notice of Applicability, or NOA. When a permittee requests to terminate their permit coverage, they submit a Notice of Termination, or NOT. This graph compares notices of applicability issued in blue to notices of termination in orange over the last 3 years. We sent no notices of applicability in 2023. We sent 13 in 2024 and none this year. With the orange bars representing the number of notices of termination approved or in the process of being approved, in 2023 we had 8. Last year we approved 10, and this year we have 3 that again have been approved or are in the process of being approved. And between 2023 and now, we've seen 13 notices of approval, notices of applicability issued, and 21 notices of termination approved or in the approval process. Next slide. Okay, and then in the next few slides, I'll highlight recent work done in the program, including inspections, enforcement, and a proposed future permit. This slide captures the different types of inspections. So starting with notice of termination inspections, once a notice of intent is submitted by the applicant, we visit the property to verify that the conditions are as they were reported in that application. Complaint inspections are conducted when we receive word of a general water quality concern or a potential permit violation. Compliance inspections are more focused and can include inspecting holding ponds, the facility's manure management program, required paperwork and on-site plans, and animal mortalities. And last, notice of termination inspections are conducted after a discharger has submitted all required documents to terminate their permit coverage. And if the property is not being transferred to a new owner, we verify that all wastewater retention ponds have been drained and scraped, that there are no animals on site, and that manure has been removed. Okay, these inspection numbers are fiscal year totals. They represent all inspection types combined. They account for notice of intent inspections, complaint, compliance, and notice of termination, all mentioned in the previous slide. And beginning in 2020 on the left, 44 total inspections were conducted, 22 inspections in fiscal year 21-22, 38 inspections 22-23, and 68 inspections in fiscal year 23-24, and 31 total inspections for this last fiscal year. So the previous slide showed the total number of inspections per fiscal year, and this is a breakdown of each inspection type. The blue bars represent notice of intent inspections, red being complaints, gray bars represent the number of compliance inspections, and orange represents notice of termination inspections. Compliance and notice of termination inspections make up the bulk of our field work, and we've seen a recent uptick in notice of termination requests. So enforcement actions are taken as a result of reporting or discharge violations. Reporting violations have been the majority of the two types, and they are triggered by late or incomplete annual reports, and progressive enforcement begins with a notice of violation and may escalate to an administrative civil liability. Any permit violations are assessed at the time of inspection. Next slide. And continuing with enforcement, this chart reflects the number of notices of violation issued between calendar year 2022 and now. Here, the reporting violations column reflects the number of notices issued for reporting violations between 2022 and now, and specifically, those notices are issued to permittees who have either not submitted their annual report or who submitted an annual report with missing required information. Again, that was for reporting violations. And the site condition violations column reflects the number of notices issued for site condition violations. And these types of violations might include exceeding a 180-day limit for stockpiling manure illicit connections to an adjacent water body, or carcasses that have not been removed from the site. And on the bottom slide, please note that violation notices that were issued this year are for 2024 annual reports. And we are still processing some reports, so these numbers may change. And this slide touches on recent accomplishments within the program. We're seeing general overall compliance with the current dairy order. We are working cooperatively with third parties who are assisting in ensuring permit compliance, and we've started drafting a new concentrated animal feeding operations permit that I'll get into in a few slides. And we've updated our website to include a landing page for the new order, and outreach efforts so far include establishing a list of potentially interested parties for draft permit feedback. And we've held initial meetings with key interested parties in 2023. And last, we've collaborated with other regions and our own TMDL staff to assist in permit development. So our program does have a few challenges, the first being non-submittals of notices of termination. In order for a discharger to terminate permit coverage, they're required to submit a notice of termination, and there's been a recent trend of permitted responsible parties vacating their sold properties without notifying us. This can cause issues with getting access to the site, waste left behind, and potential billing issues. And the landowner may be responsible for any waste left behind. Also, it can take a lot of staff time tracking down those responsible parties. Permittees don't always update us with their contact information, so reaching them can sometimes be a challenge. Permittees might not receive program updates or announcements, and we see returned mail, and issuing enforcement notices can be a challenge. Slide. And last slide, updating our permit. Finally, the current permit was set to expire in March 2024, but was administratively extended until a new order replaces it. Proposed major changes include adding regulatory language for horse, poultry, swine, and mixed animal facilities based on equivalent threat of discharge. Our current estimated number of animal facilities are as follows. Horse facilities, we have estimated fewer than 10. Poultries, less than 5. Swine facilities, less than 5. And mixed, fewer than 10. Estimated. And there may be draft precedential requirements included in the next permit. And that puts us at about the halfway point before Regina presents on non-point source and irrigated lands. I'm happy to take questions from the board, or we can wait till the end.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael. Are there any questions or comments from the board here, either here or online? Okay.
This is Bill Rue. Only to say that I think we're making a tremendous amount of progress with this. And to note for the audience that a lot of the agricultural uses, especially in the Chino and Ontario area, are declining as they move from agricultural to industrial, commercial, and residential uses. Thank you.
Okay, and then I'll just add to that. I was when you showed the map of where all these facilities are located, I was even surprised there were still facilities out in the Chino, Ontario area. Growing up as a kid back in the 1960s, they were everywhere. Nearly all those dairies are gone now. Unfortunately, the legacy of contamination from all of their operations remains, particularly the high nitrates in the groundwater, and there's still a lot of that stuff in the soil. So it's something we're going to be dealing with for a long time in other capacities outside of this program. So, thank you, Michael, and if we could have our next speaker.
Thank you.
The second half of this presentation will be given by our section's newest staff, Dr. Regina Adigwe.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning, Madam Chair and board members. My name is Regina Adigwe. I'm an environmental scientist with the Santa Ana Water Board. Today, I'll be presenting an update on the implementation of the general waste discharge requirements for discharges of waste from irrigated lands in the San Jacinto River watershed in Riverside County. This is also known as the Agricultural Order or the Ag Order. So I'll be giving an update on that, and I'll also be talking about, the agricultural program as a whole. So to start off with, I would like to introduce myself formally to you. My name is Regina Adigwe, and my background is in environmental science and engineering. I was an environmental scientist at the Department of Criminal Investigations over at DTSC before joining the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board on the 8th of April, 2025. And so I'm responsible for implementing the Ag Order through the Non-Point Source Program and the Irrigated Lands Program. I'll be starting off with the Non-Point Source Program. The Non-Point Source Program is a program that is regulated by the mandate from the Federal Clean Water Act, which requires states to develop a program to protect water resources from the adverse effects of non-point source pollution. And non-point source pollution arises from pollutants from many diffuse sources, such as agriculture, and this is much difficult to regulate than point sources of pollution. The Ag Order complies with the non-point source policy by requiring discharges to implement management practices to minimize pollution. The non-point source program is guided by the non-point source program implementation plan, and this implementation plan is updated every 5 years to reflect the current goals and priorities for the various non-point source programs in various regions. The 2025-2030 non-point source five-year plan was recently updated and submitted to the EPA, and we are currently waiting for comments from the EPA. The diagram to my right illustrates how irrigation is a major pathway for non-point source pollution in agriculture. And so runoff from irrigated lands carry pollutants either into receiving water bodies, such as rivers and lakes, or they percolate into groundwater. And so that brings us into the Irrigated Lands Program. The Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program is a program that is designed to regulate waste discharges from irrigated lands. So it uses the Agricultural Order to address irrigated agricultural discharges. The Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program monitors compliance with various aspects of the Ag Order and uses it as a tool for implementation and enforcement. The program usually holds a quarterly roundtable meeting, and updates from the various regions are sent to the State Water Board bimonthly. On this slide, I'll be talking about the implementation of the Ag Order. So the Agricultural Order was adopted on February 3rd, 2025, and this replaced the conditional waiver for agricultural discharges, also known as the QUAD. Therefore, all enrollees in the QUAD were transitioned and now enrolled in the Ag Order. Between July 1st and December 30th of 2023, staff mailed out 11 failure to apply notices to agricultural operations that are not in compliance with the Ag Order. And so, as a result of that action, as of August 30th, 2025, we have 12 new agricultural operations that have enrolled and received a notice of authorization from the Santa Ana Water Board. These 12 new operations adds about 2,085 new acres to operations enrolled under the Ag Order. To help with the implementation of the Ag Order, two coalitions exist in the Santa Ana region, and they help discharges meet the requirements of the order. So these coalitions are the San Jacinto Coalition, and we have the Western Riverside County Agricultural Coalition. This is also known as RACAC. So the San Jacinto Coalition is responsible for groundwater monitoring and reporting, while RACAC helps discharges comply with surface water monitoring and reporting and TMDL compliance. As I go through the presentation, I'll be highlighting the various roles of these coalitions. Now, I'll be talking about the major components of the Ag Order and their progress since the adoption of the order. So many of the requirements that were in the QUAD are also in the Ag Order, and I'll be highlighting any new requirements in the Ag Order as I go through the table. To enroll under the Ag Order, discharges are expected to submit an electric notice of intent, They're also expected to have a farm plan. The farm plan is also known as the Water Quality Management Plan, and this is kept on site for data collection. So data collected are usually items like the type of management practices being implemented, the type of crops and irrigation methods. A summary report is prepared from the plan and sent to the Santa Ana Water Board, along with the Irrigation Nitrogen Management Plan summary reports. So the Irrigation Nitrogen Management Plan is a new presidential requirement that is in the Ag Order, and it requires farmers to have this on site to collect nitrogen removed data. And so a summary report is prepared from the data and submitted to us by September 15th annually. And we received the first irrigation nitrogen management plan September 15th of last year, 2024, and we're expecting the next one next week. Farmers are also expected to implement management practices. The water quality improvement plan is prepared by a discharger when there has been a failure in management practices that have led to water quality exceedances or a water body degrading. And so the discharger prepares a water quality improvement plan and submits to the Santa Ana Water Board. The Water Board approves this plan before it is implemented on site. Additionally, the next requirement is the outreach and education requirement, which is expected to be done annually. And the first one was held by the San Jacinto Coalition on the 9th of April 2024. And they recently had a second one on the 6th of August, 2025, while RACAC held two educational webinars, one on the 12th of February, 2025, and the second one on the 20th of March, 2025. Another new requirement in the Ag Order is the monitoring of drinking water wells and groundwater trend monitoring. So the data for these are collected annually, but a trend report is expected to be submitted to us after the third year. And so we're currently in the second year, hoping to receive this by next year. The next requirement is the surface water monitoring and TMDL compliance. Like I said earlier on, this is done by RACAC, and the summary report is submitted along with the nitrogen management plan summary reports. Next, I'll be talking about the acres enrolled under the Ag Order. And so I have two data sets from the San Jacinto Coalition and from RACAC. So the data set from the San Jacinto Coalition ranges from 2021 to 2025. And the blue bar represents APN acres, while the orange bars represent irrigated acres. And the graph illustrates that there have been a gradual decline in active ag land over the 5 years. While the data from RACAC spans over 17 years worth of data, and the orange bar represents the irrigated land acres, while the non-irrigated land acres are the gray bars. So the non-irrigated land, as defined by the Ag Order, are lands that are cultivated using no artificial irrigation. They solely rely on rainfall. And so the total of the irrigated lands and the non-irrigated land gives us the total active ag acres, which is represented by the green line. And from the graph, we can see that there has been a huge decline in the in active ag acres since 2007. And this might have been due to the housing developments that are coming up in the area because it's becoming more popular in the region. On this slide, we have the distribution of the ag parcels in the San Jacinto Coalition. So the colored boxes represent the various crops and their location within the region. And then the dotted lines represent the groundwater management zones, while the boundary, the black bold boundary, represents the Eastern Municipal Water District. The Eastern Municipal Water District administers the San Jacinto Coalition. And so from the map, we can see that citrus, which is represented by the blue bars, are mostly located in the Canyon Groundwater Management Zone, while alfalfa is scattered all over from Perry South to Hemet North and the San Jacinto Lower Pressure Groundwater Management Zones. Now I'll be talking about the summary of the first irrigation nitrogen management plan summary report. So two major reporting requirements were needed. We have the groundwater monitoring and reporting. Like I said, this is usually done by the San Jacinto Coalition. And then we have the surface water monitoring and reporting, and this is done by RACAC. So the San Jacinto Coalition received evaluations from 17 out of 20 reporters in the coalition, representing about 93% of all acres in the coalition. The coalition reported 8,739 acres of primary crops, and primary crops are the main crops grown on a single field in a single year, while they reported 616 acres of secondary crops. And secondary crops are defined as a rotation of two crops on the same field in the same year, while they've also reported 236 acres of tertiary crops. Tertiary crops are a rotation of three crops on a single field in a single year. And so the total acreage reported was 9,591 acres. They also noted that the primary crop acreage was down by 1,452 acres from what it was in 2021 crop year. That is at 10,191. RACAC also reported similar numbers based on the acres of land. So they had evaluations from 9,907 acres of land, which was similar to what the San Jacinto Coalition reported. Looking at the main crops produced in the coalition, we have two major crops produced, which are alfalfa and grapefruit. So alfalfa is at 25% of all the crops produced in the coalition, and we have grapefruit at 23%. And then we have triticale at 13%, and other crops such as wheat, watermelon, turf at 6%, and fallowland at 6%, while other crops are below 5%. On the next slide, I'll be talking about the irrigation methods used in the coalition. And so the most popular irrigation method used is the sprinkler irrigation. And because the sprinkler irrigation was the most popular irrigation used, discharges observed best management practices, such as frequent nozzle maintenance, operating the system at design pressure using pressure gauges, and also matching the application of water to the soil infiltration rate to help reduce or eliminate runoff. So with this best management practice, they were able to reduce non-point source pollution. The next popular irrigation method is the micro sprinkler or the micro sprayer at 26%, and then we have dry land at 7%. As defined by the Ag Order, dry land entails management practices by a farmer to adapt to the presence or lack of moisture in the soil column. So rather than use regular irrigation, they use intermittent irrigation during some certain growing processes, such as germination. And because a type of irrigation is used, dry land is considered a method of irrigation. And next, we have the drip and center pivot systems at 7% each. Now, I'll be talking about the nitrogen removed data. So as per the order requirement, three nitrogen removed data was provided to us in three Excel spreadsheets. And they contained information such as the nitrogen application rates and the consumption ratios. So the consumption ratios are the nitrogen applied divided by the nitrogen removed data, and the nitrogen applied minus the nitrogen removed data using the units pounds per acre. So results showed that alfalfa green chop had A over R ratios less than 1, meaning that more nitrogen was removed than applied. For other crops such as grapefruit, triticale, and watermelon fields, they showed that the A over R ratios were less than 5, but greater than 1. This is considered normal for non-leguminous crops because only the harvested nitrogen was considered. So loss of nitrogen through other means such as denitrification and volatilization wasn't taken into account. The nitrogen application rates for some of these crops were greater than the University of California Cooperative Extension recommendation. And so what the coalition did is to provide a grower's feedback report to notify farmers when there has been nitrogen application rates that were greater than the UCCE recommendation levels. Now, the data had some regional limitations, such as one, the coalition number is relatively small. This made it kind of difficult to conduct some statistical analysis, such as outliers. Also, there are several reports in the reported data, and this affected the quality assurance and quality control. Most errors were due to fallout. And lastly, the applicability of nitrogen removed coefficients and the UCC recommended application rates have not been verified, and this may later change. In the same report, we had two pollutants that were analyzed from the groundwater monitoring and reporting. So we have the nitrate levels, the nitrate well concentrations, and the TDS, that's total dissolved solids well concentrations. And so for each groundwater management zone, the wells were categorized into two. The blue bar represents the average pollutant for wells within 0.5 mile of a parcel, while the orange bar represents the average of a pollutant for wells further than 0.5 mile of a parcel. And so for the average nitrate well concentration, we had that for most groundwater management zones, the levels were below the MCL of 10 milligrams per liter, except for Hemet South. While for the TDS well concentrations, we had levels that were above the objectives for each groundwater management zones. Now I'll be talking about the surface water monitoring and reporting. So 28 operations completed the water quality index for ARC surface water runoff evaluations. And these evaluations covered 9,907 acres of land. RACAC noted that the ARC operations were up 6 operations from the previous reporting period. So RACAC uses the water quality index ARC tool to score evaluations on a scale of 1 to 10, and a 7.2 is the recommended score for discharges in the final water quality index ARC score. So I'll be talking more about the scoring method. And so the scoring method is based on 4 factors, which are the field physical factors, and they are things like the types of soil or the type of crop. And then we have nutrient management, as well as tillage management and pesticide management. So if a farmer is able to implement up to 5 best management practices that are protective of water quality based on these 4 factors, they are most likely to score a 7.2. And the results show that 75% of evaluations scored a 7.26 out of a 10, while 50% scored 7.87, and only about 39 out of the 255 evaluations scored lower than a 7. And this isn't considered such a bad thing with RACAC, since they work with the farmers or dischargers to help identify areas where a management practice would have failed and help them improve it. Moving forward, I plan on going on more inspections of farms that are not enrolled under the ag order, and hopefully through that action, increase enrollment. I also plan to track the monitoring and reporting summary reports to help identify trends and outliers. Lastly, I plan on investigating non-compliant farms that are already enrolled under the ag order and help them be compliant or, if necessary, pursue enforcement actions. With this, I conclude my presentation. Thank you for listening.
Well, thank you very much, Regina, for the outstanding presentation, as with the previous one. It's also great to hear from a fellow DTSC alumnus. So. Board members, do we have any questions or comments on this part of the presentation?
No, other than to say thank you for a very thorough report. I was not only following my agenda, I had something on my cell phone, so I could not only see you, I could read other things. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. I could read more of the detail that way. Thank you.
And while we're online, Chair Murray, questions?
No, I agree with my colleague, Mr. Rue, it was very, very thorough and so much to digest, but really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And here in person, Board Member Lopez.
I just want to thank both of you for the report. I find it very interesting in, you know, how things are changing out in the community, you know, the encroachment of housing into these areas, you know, and I really appreciate this report. It's a lot of work that you've done, and I commend you for it.
Thank you.
Any other board members? Board Member Clark?
Thank you for the report, and welcome, Regina.
Thank you.
Great to have you on board. I was particularly interested in the stats about the support to farmers to ensure that they're meeting those numbers and getting the highest score possible. So it's just great to know that those resources are available, and we're trying to elevate, you know, folks' services out there as much as possible. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay. And then I do have a question about the overall presentation, so we might want to have Brian up there as well. So as I understand, the upshot to all of this is that we have a number of animal facilities, namely animal feeding facilities, that are not covered under the regulations. And so is the intent to bring them under the confined animal feeding operations regulations? So that's the intent here.
Yeah, that's correct, Vice Chair Scandora. So currently the order, as Michael said, it covers dairy and dairy-related facilities. And the upcoming order, we're looking to incorporate some of those other animal facilities that we have in our region, specifically kind of equestrian facilities, which we have a handful of. Mike mentioned the Los Alamitos one,
yeah.
And there's a handful of others. Previously, they did have coverage, those equestrian facilities did have coverage under the quad order, so our previous order to the agricultural order that Regina spoke about. So since that quad has been replaced by the agricultural order, those facilities have not had coverage. So we're hoping to incorporate them into the new permit.
Right. One question I had, there was a slide that showed all the different, the numbers of animals at all the facilities, and it looked like about 99% of them were all dairy, and then the remaining were the other types of animals like horses. Now, I have to admit, you know, this question, I have a little bit of bias because my grandfather was a chicken rancher in Chino way back in the 1960s. And did that 1% include the chicken ranches? Because they can have hundreds of chickens each.
No, it does not. The new draft permit will address that, but the current dairy order strictly addresses dairies and related facilities. So if you have a poultry ranch, for example, that would be included in the next order, assuming the thresholds are met.
I see. So we're going to be bringing them in. I imagine there's not many chicken ranches left anymore, just like horse ranches. And then also the other intent is to bring all the facilities that currently have waivers that have waivers also under the ag order, then. Is that correct?
Okay. So I think that's one of the goals, to have all the farms within the region that are above 20 acres enrolled under the ag order. And we are hoping that those that are not currently enrolled are going to be enrolled into the under the ag order.
Okay. And then my last question is there going to be a need for board action related to this at a future board meeting related to our agricultural facilities?
Yes. It's a little bit of a ways out. We're still in the very early stages. Like Mike had said, we had started some initial meetings back in 2023, and we're still gathering information and preparing that order. So there will be additional public meetings. We'll likely have those public meetings at a future board event.
Okay.
All of that will occur before going to the board, and of course there's reviews by state board as well as federally PA, because it will also be a CAFO permit required under NPDES.
Okay. So in other words, for all of us here on the board, we'll stay tuned on this. So thank you very much for your presentation. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards on this item?
Yes, we have two in person. The first will be Arlene Chen, followed by Ananda Kaur. Oh, I apologize. That's for item 9. So no speakers.
Okay. Thank you. Our next item. Item 9, a supplemental environmental projects list. And this is an information item as well. We have Chuck Chuck Griffin, who's a senior water resource control engineer here, and he will give a presentation on this topic.
Good morning, Board Chair and members of the board. This presentation is about our SEP program and how board staff select, develop, and potentially implement Region 8 SEP program. Can you hear me clear? Okay.
Yes.
I'll get closer. The other part of this presentation will cover SCORP's proposal to become a third-party administrator. Next slide. So what is a SEP? A SEP is a supplemental environmental project. SEPs are projects that are funded through enforcement, and discharger or the settling party agrees to offset 50% of their penalty and apply it towards an approved environmental project. An approved supplemental environmental project has strict guidelines that in part adhere to the criteria that is spelled out in the State Water Resources Control Board 2017 SEP policy. Next slide. So how are SEPs selected? Well, during settlement negotiation, a discharger may propose a SEP in which they agree to undertake and complete the SEP, or they can hire a third party who will implement and complete the SEP. A discharger may also select a SEP from a list from the Office of Enforcement or from Region 8's SEP list. There is also the option to go with a third-party administrator that has a pre-approved list of SEPs, and they basically would oversee and implement the SEP. Currently, Region 8 does not have a third-party administrator for SEPs, similar to what Northern California has for the Rose Foundation or what SCORP does for the San Diego region. Next slide. The SEP policy requires the SEP project to be spelled out in a settlement agreement or stipulated agreement. The SEP details must have a scope of work, a budget, a time schedule, reporting requirements, deliverables, specific milestones, and a final completion date. The detail included in the settlement should have performance standards, identified measures, or indicators for performance. Next slide. Generally, a SEP amounts are limited to 50% of the total liability. For mandatory minimum penalties, however, if a settlement is $15,000 or less, 100% of that money can go towards a SEP. If it's greater than $15,000, then the first $15,000 can go towards a SEP, and the remaining amount, 50% of the remaining amount, can go towards that SEP. As an example, if a settlement had $100,000 administrative civil liability, $15,000 could go to the SEP right off the top, and then 50% of the remaining $85,000 for a total amount of $57,500 going towards the SEP. Any amount not going to the SEP would go to a state board account, similar to the Water Pollution Permit Fund or the Cleanup and Abatement Account. For any amount that's greater or exceeds 50% of the liability, other than mandatory minimum penalties, they must seek approval from the director of the Office of Enforcement, and there must be compelling justification to do so. Next slide. Generally, a SEP has a time limit of 36 months. If a SEP proposal is anticipated to go beyond 36 months, again, we must seek out approval from the director of the Office of Enforcement. If an approved SEP project is experienced a delay or is anticipated to go beyond the settlement timeline, then they would seek an extension from the executive officer. Next slide. The discharger has the liability for the money spent on a SEP until that project is completed. The amount of administrative civil liability that goes towards a SEP project is considered a suspended liability, and the discharger is liable for that amount until the SEP is completed. Usually, the discharger pays 50% of the liability to the appropriate state board account, like the Water Pollution Permit Fund, Cleanup and Abatement Account, or the Water Rights Fund. Money going to the SEP can be paid all at one time or can be paid along the way. Included in the settlement is a signed agreement between the discharger and the third-party implementer if this discharger is not completing the SEP on their own. Next slide. The settlement, including the details of the proposed SEP, are posted for a 30-day comment period. Any comments received will have a response to comments. All details of the SEP are provided to the advisory team in advance of posting for public comment. At the end of the comment period, and provided no significant comments exist, the executive officer may have delegated authority to approve with consultation with the board chair, or the settlement may be presented at a board hearing in open session and voted on. Next slide. Vetting SEPs. Acceptable SEPs must meet at least one of seven categories: pollution health benefit, pollution prevention, pollution reduction, environmental restoration or protection, assessments and audits, and environmental compliance projects. If a project does not meet any of these categories, there is some flexibility in the SEP policy with the category other. Next slide. The SEP policy and the screening considerations that Region 8 staff look for is a relationship between the location of the violation and the SEP, or the nature of the violation in the SEP, all related to improving water quality and providing safe drinking water. The nexus is thought to exist if a SEP is designed to either reduce the likelihood of violations in the future, reduce adverse impacts to the public health or environment, or reduce overall risk to the public. Strong consideration is given for projects that benefit disadvantaged communities, are in environmental justice areas, or address the human right to water. Next slide. Examples of unacceptable projects are projects that only accept cash contributions without any additional benefit. Projects where there's not full responsibility either by the discharger or by the third party implementing the SEP. And then general studies or research that do not address water quality. And then projects that already have requirements from state, local, or federal agencies. Next slide. Region 8 staff solicit for potential SEPs through outreach to communities, nonprofits, NGOs, agencies, and local, state, and federal authorities within our region. As an example, staff has collaborated with the Division of Drinking Water to seek out water providers that need either wellhead treatment or water distribution system improvements, or other needs that can provide safe drinking water. Staff has worked with Eastern Municipal Water District to fund portions of aspects of the septic to sewer projects within disadvantaged communities. Staff has also reached out to Coastkeeper and has funded a beach cleanup. In each case, staff as well as the Office of Enforcement Attorneys screen for potential SEP projects to ensure that they meet either the criteria or are not part of the prohibition. Any projects that last longer than 6 months has the obligation to submit semi-annual reports and financial accountability until that project is completed. Once a project is completed, the settling party or third-party administrator shall provide a certificate of completion showing proof that the project is completed and that funds were expended. Board staff will provide a letter indicating that the discharger has met its obligation to the board and from which the suspended liability is waived. At this time, are there any questions regarding SEPs?
Board members, do we have any questions?
I think it's a very thorough presentation and very similar to what we've been doing.
Yes. Okay, at this point, I'd like to pivot. Next slide. I'd like to transition to SCORP's proposal to become a third-party administrator. Next slide. Next slide. Thanks. With the assistance of SCORP, we will explain who SCORP is, what they do, the proposal to become a third-party administrator, and then the types of SEPs being proposed, and then finally, why we have to go to the state board for approval. With this, I'd like to introduce Ken Skip from SCORP, and he will better explain who SCORP is. Thank you. Next slide. Thanks. Yeah.
Good morning, as always. It's an honor to address the board. I'd like to thank Orange County Sanitation District for hosting us today. It's a fine facility. For the record, my name is Ken Schiff. I am the deputy director at the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. We all just call it SCORP because it's a mouthful. So next slide, please. I think it was at your June meeting, our executive director came and gave you a briefing on who our agency is. So I'll give you a one-slide reminder. We're a public agency. We're actually a joint powers authority. And we've been around since 1969. And our joint powers are a unique blend of both regulatory agencies and regulated agencies. I'll provide a list in a moment. But know that this is unique because there's nothing like it anywhere else in the country. We're very lucky to have this here. So our primary mission in life is to understand the impact of human activities and natural variation on the environment, right? The aquatic environment. And then provide this information to management decision makers, just like you and your staff. And an important attribute of SCORE that'll kind of run throughout the presentation and need for today's agenda item is that we're unbiased, independent, we don't advocate, we don't litigate, we don't enforce, we don't make policy. We're just a bunch of geeky scientists and engineers trying to help you out. So let's go to the next slide. So here's the list of our member agencies. The top half you'll recognize as some of the largest regulated agencies, both wastewater, treated wastewater, as well as stormwater agencies. And then the bottom half are the state and federal regulators that oversee them. And you'll see that the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board is one of your members. And in fact, Eric is one of our commissioners. So now you know why we have to be unbiased, right? We have both on our commission. So, all right, let's go to the next slide. We have a long history of successfully completing supplemental environmental projects, or SEPs, right? We've done over 40 during the last 20 years. We haven't had one out of compliance. So many of them were water quality improvement projects, but for today's conversation, I want you to know that our most successful SEP projects tackle really thorny issues that need the independent science. So we'll feel free to stop me at anywhere along the line and ask me questions. Let's go to the next slide. So let's talk about SEPs and regional monitoring, because this is somewhat new, right? In our 20-year history of all these successful SEPs, most of them come off the traditional SEP list, which you guys kind of renew every year with the staff, or a discharger will approach us and select one. So, but in 2018, there was a new SEP strategy emerged consistent with the State Water Board's new SEP policy, and that SEP funds can be applied to regional monitoring. And so this has been adopted by the State Water Board. It's also been adopted by the Regional Water Quality Control Board in San Francisco and in San Diego. So it's not new. Let's keep going. So let's talk about regional monitoring. You may or may not be familiar with the regional monitoring programs here in Southern California. But know that they're amongst the largest, longest-running regional monitoring programs in the country. So in Southern California, we have one for freshwater. That's associated with the Stormwater Monitoring Coalition, or SMC, you'll hear it abbreviated. And then we have another one for marine waters, which is often referred to as the BITE program. BITE is just a nautical name for a bend in the coastline. So it's both of them take all of Southern California. I'll show you a map in a moment. So, but these programs have been around for 30 years. So also not new. The reason they've been around for so long is because they answer kind of critical questions that managers have about the environment. There's lots of different things they try to tackle, but they have one thing in common across all 30 years and across both freshwater and saltwater, is that they answer questions about extent and magnitude of impact. So how widespread are anthropogenic impacts, and how big of a problem are they? I'm gonna scoot over here so I can see you a little better. So, so what it does is provide managers that context of maybe you have a site-specific discharger you're trying to evaluate, so you can compare it to the rest of the region, Are they the best? Are they the worst? Are they in the middle? And, you know, so if things are widespread or high magnitude, there's a need for action. On the flip side, the regional monitoring programs also address trends, which is critical. So once you do those management actions, you know, there's a need established and you follow through with them. Now you have a regional program to see if things are actually improving. So, and then the last thing you need to know about in this snapshot of regional monitoring is while SCORP facilitates the program, right? We're kind of like the leaders of it. It's a partnership. There's well over 100 organizations that participate in it. It's not just a SCORP thing. It's a grassroots partner-built organization, and that's why it's one of the largest, longest-running programs in the country. Next slide, please. Here's a map. On the left is the marine program. On the right is the freshwater or streams program. So we'll start with the left side, the ocean. You see it runs from just north of Santa Barbara down to San Diego. So there's the bend in the coastline that I talked about being the bite. The thing to know about this is that it starts at the head of tide, right? So at the beach or in the estuary, and goes all the way down to the deepest parts of our coastal ocean. And it covers all of the marine waters included in the Santa Ana region. So on the right side, you'll see the 17 coastal watersheds that comprise our region. It goes from the headwaters up in the national forest all the way down to the beach. So I'm once again covering every watershed in the Santa Ana region. Let's keep going. I have one slide, we'll call it the slide of details that I'm going to give you. This will probably be my most detailed slide for you. We collect hundreds of sites every year in both programs. So, the main thing to know is that they address a lot of what I call hot topic issues, right? So when I talk to board members or your staff, executive management for staff, they talk to me about hot topic issues. And if we only had information on things like, is it safe to eat the fish, right? Is it safe to swim? Is the ecosystem protected? These are the types of hot topics that are being addressed. And so I can go into details on any of these, but I won't now. So just to, in the essence of time, let's keep moving forward. I want to talk about the SEP process. I told you that SCORP is already the third party for Regional Board 9, the San Diego region, and so we have a process in place. I want to outline that for you. It comes in three parts. We have a work plan phase, the settlement agreement phase, and then the reporting phase. So I'm going to have one slide on each of these. Let's go to the next slide, please. So let's talk about the work plan. This is an important piece because this is where the actual work and work products come forward. We create a work plan for each of our regional monitoring programs. It defines the scope, the costs, the schedule, the products, the quality assurance, all of the things that Chuck mentioned in what his needs are for a SEP. They're all available online. And so where the crux comes down to for the need for the SEPs is often there's way more questions and needs than there are available resources. And so what we do is still capture those and put those in the work plan, even though they're unfunded. So what you essentially have are these pre-approved, vetted by both regulators and dischargers for these unfunded projects, and we put it in the work plan. So they're essentially prepackaged projects that have been vetted and ready to go. Next slide. So I said there were three parts. We talked about the work plan. The second part is the settlement agreement. So, we don't have a lot of involvement in the actual agreement phase. What happens is when there's an agreement being reached, the water board staff will reach out to SCORP and say, hey, there's something might be coming. And so, great, we're ready for it. And then once the settlement is signed and agreed, the funds are sent to SCORP, typically through registered mail. We receive it. We notify both the the regulated party and the regional board that we've received it. And then we typically sit down with regional board staff and kind of go through the projects that are in the work plan, the vetted projects in the work plan, and say which one has the best nexus, either through issue area or location. Next slide. So there are three phases, right? The work plan, the settlement. This is the third phase, the reporting phase. The first thing to know is that SCORP logs all of the SEP funds that we receive, and the regional board also. And so we track it simultaneously but independently. And so it serves as kind of a double blind to make sure that the funds are being spent appropriately. SCORP then continues its communication with regional board staff by preparing semi-annual reports. So they get a progress report twice a year. And that's on top of the regional board staff that are involved in the regional monitoring program, you know, are paying attention to the technical details. And then the final thing is SCORP ensures that the final products meet the compliance requirements in the order. So we'll provide full reports, full accounting. Those are always done in less than 36 months. And then all of the data goes on to the state data repository, the CEDIN, or the California Environmental Data Exchange Network. Let's keep going. So I wanted to give you a few examples of the types of things that are in our work plan. I'm not going to provide any details on any of the projects, but feel free to ask me questions about any of them, and I can go into, if you're interested, or one or more of them. So we have one slide for the marine waters and one for the fresh waters, because those are our two big programs. And so here you can see these are things that we have a lot of questions about, and the managers have a lot of questions about, but just not enough resources to tackle. So things like emerging contaminants, right? We're looking at things like PFAS in the ocean, right? We're looking at current use pesticides. We're looking at hormone mimicking pollutants. And then, of course, we follow that up with a bunch of specialized toxicity testing to see if they're actually having an impact, right? Not just that we can measure them, but are they causing a problem? So extent and magnitude. We're looking at things like oceanic fish and invertebrate ecological communities, looking at things like impacts from ocean acidification, which can then confound any of your regulatory programs, right? You see a decrease in fish or invertebrate communities. Is that because of your discharger, or is that because there's just, you know, global ocean acidification that's having a problem? If you weren't doing regional monitoring, you wouldn't know. So. And then things like looking at the health risk, the human health risk of consuming shellfish. Anyways, you can see the list. Let's go on to the next slide. Here's the list for freshwater regional monitoring. It's a separate work plan, so it's got a separate list of projects. But you can see there's things that are in here that help all of the freshwater, both regulated and regulatory agencies. Like down in Region 9, they have a lot of issues associated with bioassessment and trying to develop biological objectives. And the State Board is also entertaining these types of potential regulatory thresholds. And so we're providing a lot of the information to make them useful tools, like not just invertebrates in the stream or fish in the stream, but also algae. Dealing with harmful algal blooms, right? And things like causal assessment. When you find an impaired biological community, what's causing it? So let's go to the next slide. I was asked to give one example, so this is the one that I want to provide for you. In this particular SEP that was in Region 9, it was from just 3 years ago. The SEP project was associated with creating an automated, a rapid screening tool to say, okay, if I have impaired biological communities or impacted biologically, what's causing it? And so, right, so you can get to the next step of trying to fix it. And in this case study in particular, was in the San Luis Rey River. And the outcome, while we helped the San Luis Rey River, as part of our regional monitoring program, it turned out that this tool is technically robust enough that it can be used in any watershed throughout the region, including in the Santa Ana region. So, and you can see it has a variety of stressors or pollutant impacts that we can evaluate. Let's go to the next slide. This is really tells you a good example. So this graphic is a map of the San Luis Rey River. It comes out right by Oceanside in San Diego County, and it goes all the way inland into the National Forest. It flirts with the boundaries with Region 8. That's why I picked this one. So it's very close to you. Each of the dots on this map are one of the regional monitoring sites in the stream, so you can kind of get a sense of density and how we structure things, you know. If the map is anything except for that kind of greenish-blue color, that's a site that has an impacted a biological community. And so the question is, what is causing that, you know, that potential impairment, which is a requirement for some of the 303D listing for that region? So in this case, the warmer the color, the more likely it is that nutrients or eutrophication were the causative factor for the impaired biological community. And the reason why this is important is because this nexus to the SEP was a sewage spill. So lots of nutrients. So, and some of these sites are near the spill and some aren't. Once again, giving you the context of extent and magnitude. So, all right, let's go next slide. This is my last slide. Kind of gives you, you know, you now have a flavor of who SCORP is and why we do what we do. You have a flavor of the regional monitoring program and how extensive they are and how long running they are. So they're not going away anytime soon. You have a sense of the value that it brings and some example SEP projects. Know that we update these work plans periodically, so we kind of never run out of potential projects, or there's always potential issues and questions to be answered. Our freshwater work plan is updated annually. Our next revision will be in 2026. And our marine work plan is revised every 5 years. Our next one is in 2027. So that concludes my portion of the presentation. I thank you for the time. I'll be glad to entertain any questions.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, do we have any? I did notice there's some more slides. Do we plan on going through those, or are those just
Those are for your staff member to present.
Okay, so those are supplemental slides. Okay, well, thank you very much, Kenneth, for the excellent presentation. Board members, do we have any questions? None from here, online?
Good.
Remotely?
Thank you again for your time.
Okay. And actually, you're not out of the woods yet. I did have a couple questions and comments, so.
Yeah.
Sure. And actually, and Chuck maybe for this. So basically, with the what's interesting about this, when we think about SEPs, I always think about, at least in our realm, projects that restore aquatic habitats or replace invasive riparian vegetation with native vegetation, so the actual physical projects. This is going to be a little bit different, where now SEP money for SEPs can be used to fund monitoring projects. And now, one question I have, and this may be more for Chuck, who actually decides whether whether funds from a settlement would go to a monitoring SEP versus a physical project?
Actually, that would be a better question for your staff member.
Yeah.
So basically, it's the discharger first is the one that has to voluntarily select the SEP. At that point, if sometimes they have a SEP that they propose, and if we've screened it and it's viable, then we'll accept it. Otherwise, they may pick from a list, and at which case, if they pick from a list that's already from the Office of Enforcement or from Region 8 SEP list, then it's already been a project that's been vetted and approved upon. So that, you know, it's pretty much up to the discharger, then up to us, and up to management whether or not the project is viable and looks like it'll go forward. And that's our biggest concern, is we want to make sure that the project is successful. So we are very critical of projects before they even get written into a document.
So at the end of the day, it's the discharge who actually decides whether to, first of all, whether to participate in the SEP program and then the type of SEP that's performed. Now, another thing is we have a lot of these, I mean, we have obviously 6 and 7 digit settlements, and those are obviously good for those kinds of physical projects. But then we have these smaller settlements that are only a few thousand dollars or in the low tens of thousands of dollars. And it seems to me those kinds of projects might be, you know, great for this kind of, for the monitoring program.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's the intent.
And that's the reason why we have to go to the state board, because technically it's prohibited for, it's considered a cash donation if we just accept cash and let the discharger off the hook. However, luckily San Francisco and San Diego has already kind of broken the glass ceiling on that. And so we're going to ask for the same thing. And that's the reason, I think our justification is the fact that we're working off a vetted list, a list that we've scrutinized, and we're working with a partner we know can complete the project.
So for us to be able to implement that kind of program, we're going to need a resolution. Yes. from the State Water Board. So my last question is there anything you need from the board here with respect to this? I mean, you know, it's a great presentation, but is there action that's going to be needed from the board or that you would like the board to take?
No action other than, you know, it'd be great if board can endorse the staff efforts and move forward up to state board, because I'm sure somebody's going to call down to you guys and ask, hey, is this sound?
Yeah, and it's perhaps for the executive officer's report when that resolution does happen, if we get a heads up on that. So
we will move quickly and try and get this going, because it takes some time to get on the board calendar up at state board.
Okay. And last of all, Jessica, are there any speaker cards on this particular item?
Sorry, I wasn't quite finished.
Oh.
It's okay. So real quick, I'll just go through again, why SCORP? So SCORP's already facilitating monitor programs within the region. SCORP is already poised to answer critical water quality questions and has a proven track record. They already maintain separate accounting for their BITE and their stormwater monitoring. They have a list of vetted projects already ready to go. And they have a solid reputation for conducting projects with the goal of water quality and enhancement. The San Diego Regional Board already has this program going on, and basically staff will be asking for the same resolution from state board. Next slide. The location of the SEPs, again, are within the Region 8's boundary. Between the Stormwater Coalition and the BITE, they will cover both the inland waters and ocean waters. The SEP projects will be coordinated between the regional monitoring projects, again, the regional monitoring projects that are unfunded, but are listed because they feel that they have a benefit value to our region. The projects addressed in the SEP money must be completed within 36 months. That is non-negotiable. The 2019 Santa Ana Board SEP resolution endorsed the Region 8 SEPs back in 2019, but it also acknowledged the need to find a third-party administrator. The desire was a result of the staff time necessary to verify that SEPs are being completed or implemented correctly. Having a third party would lessen the amount of staff time that would be needed to oversee SEPs. Since the SEP policy went into effect, there has been a sharp decline in the number of discharges willing to take on a SEP, mainly because they're not willing to take on the responsibility, the time, or the liability necessary for SEP completion. They'd rather pay and go. However, what is proposed here will deviate from the strict SEP policy requirements already in place, and so it will need a state board resolution to get that forward. Next slide. Earlier, we discussed the SEP policy and some of the criteria, categories, and prohibitions. Next slide. The policy, it does acknowledge within it that strict application of every policy requirement may be inappropriate in some circumstances. Although the third-party administrators are an accepted path within the SEP policy, this proposal will allow the settling parties to immediately be released from liability And once the funds were transferred to SCWRP, the burden performance then falls on the SCWRP, who will complete and implement the project. It would also allow SCWRP as the administrator to aggregate funds because, again, mandatory minimum penalties are for smaller amounts, and quite frankly, that amount of money will not fund any meaningful project on its own. Next slide. The board resolution we're seeking would address waiving some specific requirements that are not in strict conformance with the SEP policy. The state board would allow studies without the discharger's commitment to address the findings, which is a requirement in the SEP policy. It would allow for the establishment of an account similar to the San Francisco Water Bay's account for the San Francisco Estuary Institutes of Regional Monitoring. The state board resolution would allow the Santa Ana Water Board to release liability once funds are provided to SCWRP. Board staff believe that fundamentally SCWRP will be making recommendations and take steps, and steps can be taken to address the findings in those reports and studies. The funds provided would ultimately result in a commitment to provide specific outcomes. Once recommendations are received from SCWRP, board staff can begin to work on those findings and recommendations. The state, next slide. Next slide. The state board resolution would authorize the Santa Ana Water Board to utilize SCWRP as the third-party administrator, spelling out how and when the policy requirements can be waived. Unless otherwise specified in a resolution, the SEP policy must be followed. Limited use of funds to projects that are not otherwise legally required will be one of the requirements. Projects that have a nexus within our region, and then allow the account money in the account to be aggregated until enough money is available to viably fund a project. If funds are not expended in 36 months, they must be returned to the appropriate state board account. SCWRP will track and provide accountability, and they will provide semi-annual reports and make all results and findings available to the public. Staff believe that the intent of the SEP policy to address findings would be met. A vetted list of projects will exist ahead of time. However, the projects may need to change or basically the time it takes to aggregate funds, the conditions may change. And so having a precise and detailed description of how that money is going to be spent is not reasonable in the fact that it can change. So that basically we'll be referring to that vetted list. And again, SCWRP is already doing work. They're facilitating planning discussions, drafting monitoring plans, coordinating monitoring efforts, tracking costs, implementing projects with quality assurance controls, and then they compile and disseminate the data in final reports. SCWRP and its members already have a commitment for favorable outcomes within our watershed, and it's not necessary to hold the dischargers accountable until the project is completed. Board staff would still continue to solicit other SEPs, particularly those that further the human right to water or within environmental justice areas or disadvantaged communities. At this point, if there are any other questions, I'm here to answer them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Chuck, and I apologize. I thought the remaining slides in our handout were actually for FYI, but I didn't realize they were all part of the presentation, and a lot of my questions actually got to the content of your slides. So, are there any other board member questions or comments related to this last part of Chuck's presentation?
No, other than to say a very thorough and well-done presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. And well, thank you very much, and keep us informed on the status of the state board resolution. And Jessica, do we have any more speakers?
We have two speakers for this item. The first will be Arlene Chun, followed by Ananda Kaur.
Good morning, Chair Murray, Vice Chair Escandura, board members. Arlene Chun with the San Bernardino County Flood Control District. The district is located at the headwaters of the Santa Ana watershed, and we also represent the area-wide stormwater program on the Southern California Monitoring Coalition, which SCWRP is the administrator for. Now, having SCWRP as a third-party SEP administration is wonderful for the Santa Ana watershed and the regional monitoring program. This will continue to ensure continuance of and benefit water quality efforts already in the Santa Ana watershed, as well providing additional scientific monitoring data and supporting the collaborative management decisions we develop together within the Santa Ana watershed. So I just wanted to get up and say thank you for your time in considering SWRP as a third-party administrator. Thanks.
Good morning, board members. My name is Amanda Carr. I'm Deputy Director for OC Environmental Resources at Orange County Public Works. I represent the county, the Flood Control District, and the 34 cities in Orange County. Like Mr. Lindberg, I'm also a SWRP commissioner, and the county participates both in the BITE program and in the SMC, so in the Inland Regional Monitoring Coalition. And I just wanted to highlight an additional benefit from SCORP-led projects and having SEPs go into the regional monitoring that we do is while Eric and I are on the commission and we see the final products and the public sees the final products that come out of this, our staff are sitting on the SMC committees and the BITE committees, and so our staff are working collaboratively to develop the questions and the study protocols and reviewing the data and vetting the outcomes. So beyond the ultimate reports that come out of these efforts, what we have is a forum for the regulated community and the regulators to work collectively answering common questions, developing the questions, agreeing on what the data says, and moving forward. And so building that common understanding, building that working relationship on non-enforcement issues, on hopefully non-confrontational issues, but developing that working relationship, developing that common understanding and, you know, recognizing professional integrity, I think is a huge bonus from this. And so I would strongly support having SCORP as the SEP administrator, and happy to answer any questions, but wholeheartedly support the recommendation.
Okay, thank you very much. And this concludes item number 9. It is now my pleasure to go to item number 10, the executive officer's report. It is my pleasure to introduce to all of you our new executive officer, Eric Lindberg. Eric has been with this agency for about a dozen years, worked in all throughout many programs in this agency, and then prior to that, he was also a consultant. He is a geologist by training, worked on a lot of projects, including many here in the Santa Ana region. Eric.
Thank you, Vice Chair Scandura. I'd like to deliver a couple. Yeah, a little bit. Thank you, Vice Chair Skinder. There are a couple things I'd like to share as part of the EO report. So the Newport Bay Copper TMDL was adopted by the State Water Resources Control Board on August 5th under Resolution 25-0023. As you know, that TMDL came before this board. It was originally intended to update the TMDL from 2002, so this has been an extensive effort. So the TMDLs were approved by this board in December of 2022, formally adopted by the state board, as I said, in August. The next step is the administrative record is under legal review right now, with submittal to the Office of Administrative Law scheduled for November 4th, 2025. The implementation plan for that TMDL, which is what the 2002 TMDL was lacking, includes a phased 12-year schedule to bring the bay into compliance. And while individual boat owners are the largest source of copper discharges to the bay, the city of Newport Beach and the county of Orange are expected to lead implementation due to their management of marina leases and moorings. At the state board hearing, I expressed our board's commitment for staff to work with stakeholder entities toward pragmatic solutions to this challenging issue. The next item I'd like to share is the staff's participation in the Cactus Basin Technical Advisory Group. This group has a charter to discuss, identify, and potentially recommend actions to facilitate a groundwater recharge effort proposed to be located at the Cactus Basins, which are a series of flood control detention basins in the county of San Bernardino overlying the Rialto groundwater management zone. The group has met twice to date with three additional meetings scheduled right now. I expect that those will play out over the next 3 months, and then we'll see where we are. Staff's participation in this effort is consistent with the governor's water supply strategy, which compels state agencies to prioritize groundwater replenishment projects. I'll keep the board informed and perhaps bring the group here to present an information item at a future meeting. Since our last meeting, Executive Officer Jane Joy retired. Her last day was July 31st. Staff held a luncheon in her honor and a dessert social event. I believe Jane's here today with us. The next item is the Assistant Executive Officer vacancy. That vacancy advertisement has closed. We will consider candidates, and I plan to fill this vacancy quickly, so an announcement is possible by the next board meeting. Fingers crossed. And the last item is just a note that the chair's meeting is coming up in Sacramento on October 3rd. And that concludes my executive officer's report.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Eric. Any comments or questions from the board members? Okay. Our next item, any communications from our board members? See any here? Any remotely? Okay. Well,
I just want to thank everyone today for all the presentations and congratulate and welcome Eric Lindberg in his new role, and to give my very best wishes to Jane. I'm sorry to miss her today, but greatly value and appreciate her leadership as our prior executive officer for so many years and her service to our region. So just wish you all the best.
Okay, well, thank you. Our next item is item number 12, and that is there will be a tour of the Orange County Sanitation District wastewater treatment plant, and it's expected that this tour will depart about 11 o'clock from the lobby, and at the end of that tour, we will be adjourning this meeting. But before we all go on the tour, I'd like to then move on to item number 13. Speaking of the devil who sits in the back of the room, I'd like to ask immediate past Executive Officer Jane Joy to come forward. And I can't believe how relaxed you look. So, anyway, it is my pleasure to present to you a resolution from the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board. And I'd like to say that whereas Jane Joy earned a degree in chemical engineering from UC San Diego, she managed a broad array of environmental programs in Southern California, including water and wastewater treatment, groundwater studies, and remediation and solid waste management. Jane Joy began her career managing environmental programs at the Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton in the 1980s. I actually met her at the in some meetings in the mid-1990s on Camp Pendleton. She transitioned to lead environmental programs at the Eastern Municipal Water District in 2001, and she was selected to be the Assistant Executive Officer for this board in November 2017, becoming the Executive Officer nearly 4 years later. Under Jane Joy's leadership and vision, the Santa Ana Water Board has been known for collaborating with stakeholders to develop creative and innovative solutions to the region's water quality issues. Jane Joy has demonstrated expertise, problem-solving abilities, and heartfelt dedication to the mission of the Santa Ana Water Board. She has been instrumental in addressing water quality challenges related to prolonged drought and emerging contaminants such as PFAS, ensuring the protection of water quality in the Santa and a watershed and benefiting the communities. She has been a strong advocate for racial equity and environmental justice. She led the development and implementation of the Santa Ana Water Board's Racial Equity Plan, which aims to advance racial equity and environmental justice within the region. That plan includes strategic objectives such as integrating racial equity into policies and programs, creating spaces for inclusion and belonging, and activating the BIPOC community wisdom and sharing power and knowledge with communities. Jane Joy's efforts have led to significant progress in addressing racial inequities, environmental justices, and the Santa Ana Water Board programs policies are equitable and inclusive. And the Santa Ana Water Board expresses its deep gratitude to Jane Joy for her long distinguished career protecting and improving the water quality of our local waters. Therefore, be it resolved that the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board profoundly thanks Jane Joy for her service and many accomplishments and wishes her the very best in her future endeavors. It will be signed by our chair, Chris Murray, and myself as vice chair. So thank you for all that you've done for us. And Jane, do you have a couple words to say?
I do. You know, when you get to be in this phase of life, you do really do reflect back, and I begin to recognize that the path that you choose, you're not alone, and several have come along beside me and helped me to learn how to do environmental. I have one mentor, which is Lieutenant Colonel Tony Packard. He's retired, and I just spoke to him last week, and he's been one of my mentors for a long time, and one of the things he goes, I told him I finally retired, and he goes, oh, no more politics, huh, Jane? And I'm like, okay. But it was just, we don't walk alone. We walk together. We learn from each other. We might have different opinions on many things, and with all the things that were happening this week with the assassination, it just brought clear how important it is that we respect and respect other people's opinions and what they choose to believe is what they choose to believe, and that's how we're put together. I'm getting philosophical, but I think that's what happens when you begin to get to be my age. But what a great honor it has been to be your executive officer. I enjoyed it immensely, and I am so thrilled at the work that gets done within this region. It just is top-notch. It's the best work that I've seen done for many, many years over the, and looking at what's happening throughout the state. We're often the example. So I wish you well, and I just thank you for all your kind words. I'm very honored to be here.
And thank you, Jane. And board members, do you have any comments? And I'll begin at the end with Board Member Lopez.
I would just like to say thank you very much for that short period that I've served on the board, and you were very helpful in bringing me up to date on everything, and I really appreciate that. And I after reading this, I didn't realize the impact that you had on the board and the agency, and I appreciate that. And the best of luck to you in your future endeavors.
This is Bill Rue. Jane, you've done a great job for us. We appreciate everything. I really have enjoyed working with you. Also, to know that, when you came in, you had a great deal of expertise and institutional knowledge, and that's what's helped to keep us going, is all of that, as well as your dedication. We're going to miss you. I know you don't live that far away. Come by and visit us. But most of all, enjoy this time with your family. Thanks.
Hey, Board Member Alvarado.
Just wanted to echo the multiple words and just saying thank you. Thank you for the legacy. Thank you for the work and for all the support personally, all the support as I came on to the board. I think it was very important to feel guided and to feel that we can call and ask for help. So I just wanted to say thank you personally for all the support you gave me.
Board Member Clark.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I want to give kudos to whoever wrote this resolution. It really is beautiful. They did a really great job. Jane, I know we expressed some sentiments at the last meeting, but I'd like to reiterate that. And I just think it's amazing that your legacy and your tenure is synonymous with innovation and problem solving, but the heart and the spirit and the soul is still all in there. And so I think amazingly what you brought to the table was not only that technical expertise, but the heart and that servant leadership that you don't always see bubble up to the surface in some of these more technical public service roles. So I really do admire and appreciate that about you. And I want to thank you for also mentoring and supporting Eric. We know that he'll do a great job in his service. And so we're just full of gratitude for your service. And thank you for allowing us to celebrate you one more time today.
And Chair Murray.
Thank you. I mean, what Board Member Clark just said is just, I can't add anything more. It's just so poignant and on point. But just, you know, from me personally, just how much I respect and valued working with you and appreciate your service. It truly was servant leadership. I think that was perfect how Letitia Clark phrase that. You're always available to us as board members, to community members, regardless of position or rank. You would be responsive immediately, and that is your legacy above and beyond your technical expertise. So hope to see you another time. Since I can't be there today, I would really like to plan that with you one-on-one, and just hope you all have fun on the tour, and please give Jane a hug for me since I can't be there today. Thanks, everybody.
All right, and as for me, I echo everything that my fellow board members have said, and I'll plan on giving a hug for you for the chair. And Jane is the third executive officer that I've worked with in my career. Each one has successively raised the bar for their successors, and I'm greatly looking forward to working with Eric as the new executive officer. But on behalf of the entire board, thank you for everything that you have done for us. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards?
Yes, so we have two speakers, Arlene Chun and Ananda Kaur.
Good morning, we meet again. Arlene Chun with the San Bernardino County Department of Public Works. I serve as the engineering manager of the Environmental Management Division. So my division oversees our two stormwater programs. So that's the Santa Ana Area Watershed, we are all familiar with, as well as the Mojave River Watershed Group. But the other half of my division is also the 44401 Ecological and Cultural Compliance Groups for Public Works. So we go all the way to Needles and the Arizona-Nevada border. I've known Jane since I was just starting out in stormwater. We were with our previous agencies, working alongside regional board staff at the time, and here I go, dating myself, when we were developing the Canyon Lake Lake Elsinore TMDL. So there was no TMDL at the time when we were all in that task force. Jane, you were calm, pragmatic, collaborative. As a stormwater newbie, sitting and observing in that task force, I saw the beauty of many agencies coming together, at times being frank about what our challenges are within our own agencies. And here we are again. I'm sorry to say, but I will still continue to do the stormwater, but I am very grateful that we had the past five or so years to be together at the table again. Thank you for your leadership as we work to renew the MS4 permit. We will keep that going with Eric and staff, but I would like to especially thank you for your leadership and guidance. Last year around this time, as you remember, we were going through the line fire. So immediately after the line fire, we were very worried about the potential debris flows that our communities in Mentone and the city of Highland would experience. Thank you and staff for your assistance in helping us prepare for those emergencies. We are closing out the initial emergencies, and we're working again with continuing on for the next 3 to 5 years to keep protecting those communities. Jane, congratulations on your retirement. On behalf of the Environmental Management Division, Public Works, Flood Control District, San Bernardino County, and our cities, I wish you a long, relaxing, and memorable retirement. Congratulations, Jane.
Thank you.
Well, again, Amanda Carr, County of Orange, Flood Control District, County, and 34 Orange County cities. Hard to follow up on all the lovely words and sentiments that Arlene presented, but I think the only thing that I would add is, Jane, to your point, what you were saying that you were hoping for, your leadership exemplified that. I always felt heard and respected, and I'm going to get choked up. So I will be brief, but thank you for all of your hard work and your leadership and the model that you leave for the rest of us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Amanda. And do we have any other speaker cards?
No, we do not.
Okay. Well, this concludes the portion of the meeting here in this room. We are now going to proceed to item number 12, which is a tour of the sanitation district's plant. Once we are done with that tour, we are going to adjourn to the next regularly scheduled board meeting, which will be October 24th, 2025, in Board Member Rue's stomping grounds, which is the Montclair City Hall. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry. Don't we take action on the resolution?
We don't have to take formal action, but if the board members want to have a ceremonial vote, we can do that.
Okay. Do I have a motion for approval of the resolution?
I so move.
I will second it.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Congratulations. Resolution is approved. It was close, huh? Thank you very much.